Thanks very much, Hugh. And it's pretty honoured to follow Doug Diamond and my old drinking buddy, Mr. Kashyap, with their work on liquidity. In fact, having heard that, it's not clear I've got a hell of a lot left to say. Hopefully what I am going to say is not orthogonal to what Doug just said. So I am going to talk about the practical implementation of the liquidity regime that Doug was talking about in Australia. So I want to recap some of its features, particularly how they relate to us, the Reserve Bank, and discuss some of the impact that it's having on market pricing at the moment. So as Doug mentioned, an important aspect of the Basel III liquidity standard, the liquidity coverage ratio, or LCR, comes into effect in under 1 month's time at the beginning of 2015. The other part of the liquidity standard that Doug was talking about, the net stable funding ratio, has got a little bit longer before it comes into effect. But anyhow, the LCR requires, as Doug said, that the banks hold sufficient high-quality liquid assets to withstand a 30-day period of stress. So the amount of assets a bank needs to hold is determined by the composition and maturity structure of its balance sheet. So the more liabilities that roll off within a 30-day window, the more high-quality liquid assets that need to be held. Now, one thing I agreed with a lot of what Doug said in terms of the motivation of this. The other aspect which he didn't mention is by having high-quality liquid assets, so A, they're easy to price and easy to lend against from a central bank point of view. The other thing is it actually buys you a bit of time, which is important. Time actually matters in dealing with liquidity runs. And so if they've got banks, which the assets the bank can liquefy in the market or can lend to the central bank, the more of those they've got, the more time you've got to try and solve the situation at hand. Less of those you've got, the less time you've got. So, as I said, the more liabilities that roll off within that 30-day window, the more liquid assets you need to hold. At the same time, particular types of investors or depositors are assumed to be less stable than others. So some investors are stable depositors, some aren't. The more of the unstable type you have, the more liquid assets you have to hold against that. So as has been known for some time, the Australian financial system doesn't have an especially large stock of high-quality liquid assets, for good reasons, not bad. The only instruments that have been deemed to meet the Basel liquidity standard are debt issued by the Commonwealth and state governments, along with cash balances with us, the Reserve Bank. We don't have any other liquid assets outside that. So the banking system's overall liquidity needs are actually greatly in excess of what could be reasonably held in those assets. So to put some numbers on this, APRA has determined that for next year, the Australian banking system's liquidity needs amount to around about $450 billion. The total stock of CGS and semis on issue today amounts to around $600 billion. So if the banks were to attempt to meet their liquidity needs solely by holding only CGS and semis, it'd have a few problems. Firstly, any attempt to do so probably wouldn't work because there are a large number of other entities out there who also like to hold CGS and semis, both domestic and internationally. So, for instance, currently around two-thirds of the stock of government debt is held offshore. So it would be difficult for the banks to try and buy that. Second, in the process of trying to buy that debt, even if they did try to do that, the liquidity of the market for those securities would be seriously compromised. So if the banks have bought up all the existing stock on issue, there isn't actually any market left to be liquid. So that would be completely self-defeating. As I said, the overall aim is to hold more liquid assets, not hold all liquid assets. So to address these circumstances, an important component of the liquidity regime in Australia is the Committed Liquidity Facility. There are a lot of three-letter acronyms in this stuff, or four sometimes, where on the payment of a 15 basis point fee to us, the Reserve Bank, banks will be able to obtain a commitment from us to provide liquidity against a broader range of assets under repo. So APRA has recently, in the last month or so, determined that the total CLF requirements of the Australian banking system for next year amount to around $275 billion. So how did we come up with that number, or they come up with that number? So it's first determined by assessing the amount of CGS and semis that could be reasonably held by the banks without unduly affecting market functioning. So that was our job to do that because we are fairly active in that market as well. And our assessment was around about $175 billion out of that overall stock of $600 billion. So given that number, the CLF amount that APRA determined is simply you take the overall liquidity needs of the banking system, take off the stock of HQLA that they can hold, and then you're left with the CLF amount, which is, as I said, around $275 billion for next year. So the banks that require a CLF from us need to sign a deed of agreement with us. They're doing that right at the moment. And they need to pay their fee before the 31st of December this year, because they need to pay us in advance. So from the beginning of next year, the arrangement for the 1st of January, or the 2nd actually, I think, because the 1st is a holiday, the arrangement comes into effect, provided they've paid their fees. I have talked about some of the impact on pricing in various markets of the new liquidity regime. And so one, we've attempted to before, so I'm just going to go through a few of them, others of them now. So this shows you the increase in the stock of HQLA, or local HQLA, of the banking sector over the last few years. So we've attempted to, as I said, to limit the impact on the price of CGS and semis by the banks increasing their holdings, as I've shown here. But obviously, because they are holding more, then that has had an effect on the price. So the price is higher and the yield lower than otherwise would be the case. So as I said, they've increased their stock. Now they're basically there today. So the impact on the price of CGS and semis has basically already happened. But overall, we think the impact on pricing here is actually pretty small. The larger changes have been around deposit pricing and the terms and conditions of deposits, which I'll come to shortly. But there have been some other effects which are worth commenting on. So firstly, a less discussed aspect of the liquidity standard is the requirement for a demonstrated internal liquidity transfer pricing model, which sounds complicated. But basically, the banks need to price, to include in their pricing for various products, the actual cost of liquidity, which is something that traditionally they hadn't done, or at least not obviously. So as a result of them now fully pricing the liquidity cost of various facilities that they offer and products that they offer, this has had an effect and changed prices and terms in a number of different products. So one noteworthy example is a line of credit. So banks often used to give lines of credit, didn't really price for the fact that if they actually needed to provide that line of credit, they'd actually need to have some funds to lend into that. So that clearly has a liquidity cost which wasn't fully priced for, if it was priced for at all in the past. Moreover, you're most likely to have to draw on that line, or an institution you provided that line of credit to is probably going to need to draw on that line of credit in a stress situation. And so that may have a further liquidity cost for you. On the other hand, thinking about it on the other side, longer fixed-term deposits are more attractive to banks now than they used to be, because they obviously, amongst other things, don't roll off in a 30-day window. And consequently, they've been repriced upwards, and I'll come back to that in a minute. A second impact we've seen has been, where it's been more evident recently, is a widening in the spread between bank bills and the expected policy rate. So this is a graph between the bank bill swap rate, which is the primary reference rate for credit products in Australia, so the LIBOR equivalent in Australia, for those of you not from Australia, and the expected policy rate. So in the crisis, when this thing widened, that was generally not a good sign. As you can see in here, it has widened recently at the 6-month and 3-month tenors, although it hasn't really moved much at all at the 1 month. And this has, we think, got a fair bit to do with the imminent arrival of the new liquidity regime. So while, as I said, in the crisis, this would be a sign of stress in the banking system, if you look at other measures of stress, like CDS spreads or longer-term bond prices, then they haven't moved much at all. So this is very much a function of something going on in the short-term money market and not reflective of stress in the system as a whole. So, as I said, we think this is a function of the new liquidity regime. And it's, as you can see, the widening is most pronounced at longer bank bill maturities and indeed is pretty much negligible at the one-month bank bill. This is because issuing a one-month bank bill now has very little attraction to a bank. You're issuing one-month bank bill, which guarantees it rolls off within 30 days, basically. So its liquidity cost is pretty high. You pretty much, if you issue one of these things, you have to turn around and buy a liquid asset with it. So there's not necessarily a hell of a lot of point in that. And so there's not much incentive to issue at the 1 month, whereas there's much more incentive to term out your short-term funding. Consequently, there's been more issuance of 6-month bills, less issuance of 1 month bills. So to give you some numbers on this, over the last couple of months, the stock of 6 month bills has increased by 11% and 12-month bills by 43%. In contrast, the stock of bills outstanding with an original term to maturity of less than 5 months has declined by around 10%. So the banks are very, as we've very much rolled into the window over which the LCR is going to start to kick in, the banks have very much termed out their short-term funding. Another development is that the cost of Aussie dollars in the forward FX market has been quite elevated of late. So this high price in the forward markets has been due to a number of factors, including the tendency of hedge funds to fund their Aussie dollar shorts in this market, and there's been a little bit of that going on of late, as well as an increase in the use of this market by foreign bank branches to fund their Aussie dollar lending. But there's also something related to the introduction of the liquidity coverage ratio, which we think is having an impact on that market. So historically, Australian banks have tended to raise a significant share of their short-term funding in foreign markets, mostly in US dollars, and then swap them back into Aussie to fund their Aussie dollar-denominated asset base, which is basically all of their asset base. They would swap these foreign currency, so they'd issue the foreign currency instrument, leave it in foreign currency until the swap price was relatively attractive. Under the new liquidity regime, the cost of leaving that money in foreign currency for a short period of time is actually higher. So this is a less attractive thing. Combined with a higher swap cost because of the pressure from those other sources, the all-in cost of short-term offshore funding is higher. And so the other reason why the six-month bank bill rate is... why the price has gone down and the yield has gone up is because they're, rather than issuing more of the short-term funding offshore, they bought their short-term funding back onshore because, as I said, because of the wide increased cost of that offshore funding. So let me finish just by turning to the impact of the LCR on deposit pricing. So at least Australians should be somewhat familiar with this picture. This shows the change in the funding composition of banks in Australia. So you can see around about 2008, the rise in the deposit share to about 57% currently, and offsetting that, the large decline in short-term debt. And as I said, even within that, the composition of that has changed as well. So the average maturity of that is much longer than it used to be in the past, as well as some decline in the use of long-term debt and clearly in securitisation. So to get that increase in deposit share, there were a couple of things going on. First of all, there was a preference amongst investors to hold more deposits, but more particularly, that preference was well and truly enhanced by the banks actually paying more for these deposits. The other thing you can notice here is that actually the share of short-term or of deposit funding, has actually levelled off over the last year or so. So the banks actively sought to increase their deposit share by offering higher interest rates. So the interest rate on both at call and term deposits rose markedly compared with money markets of equivalent maturity. So here we go. So banks, depositors used to get paid a hell of a lot less than money market instruments in Australia for a very long period of time, but those rates have risen considerably. So it's gone from term deposit specials, again for those not from Australia, the banks like offering special, which is a some random maturity of a number of months, 4, 5, 6, 7 months, which has a particularly attractive rate. So if you look at there's not a smooth term structure, it sort of spikes at whatever special rate, whatever maturity rate is most useful to the bank at that particular time. But anyway, nevertheless, that's the sort of generic term deposit product. So it's gone from paying 50 basis points less than a bank bill to paying up to 150 basis points more. As you can see, that spread has come down a bit of late, both as the cost of money market funding has gone up as well as the banks backing off in terms of deposit competition over the last 6 months or so. So there's been a very clear repricing in products. There's also been a change in terms and conditions for these banks. So as I said earlier, some people are deemed to be stickier deposit holders than others. So there's an incentive to change your deposit mix to those people who have behaviourally more sticky. So part of that transition is induced by price signals. So you get people to move to longer term deposits, for instance. But also some of the conditions are changed. So, for instance, there's now somewhat inappropriately named... well, it's not inappropriate, its acronym is inappropriate. So there's a notice of withdrawal account, which means once you get down to 31 days, you have to give the bank that there's a notice of withdrawal. If you think about what the acronym for that, it's NOW. So what this thing is definitely not is not a NOW account, but it's actually a notice of withdrawal account. So that means that those deposits are guaranteed not to mature within that 30-day window without... coming back to some of the points that Doug Diamond was making, without the investor making it very clear that they are going to take that money out within that time period. So there's been a lot of there's been changes around the terms and conditions of deposits to actually make them. So if it is a 12-month deposit, it really is a 12-month term deposit and not a 12-month deposit, which I might withdraw after I've only had the money there for 1 month. So we've seen a lot of those conditions change, and we've seen a lot of the pricing change. Over the last little while, it's actually settled down, and as you can see, the bidding up of deposit rates has actually come off a fair bit. Some of it is also, as you can see, it hasn't come off quite so much on the at-call savings account. That's in large part a function of the slope of the yield curve. So the fact that the yield curve's a lot flatter now, investors need aren't quite so keen to put their money at term when they can get pretty much the same rate for a shorter maturity. There's also, as I said, some evidence that the banks have been transitioning depositors into deposit products which are treated more favourably under the LCR, regardless of the rate they're actually offering. But banks are not limited to just changing their deposit offerings. We could see them look for more opportunities to package retail deposits with other products, because the deposits of customers that are also that have other relationships with the bank, for instance, are deemed to be more stable than the under the LCR. So we're seeing quite a rebranding of terms and conditions right across, particularly on the retail offering. So just to finish off, the full implementation of the new liquidity regime in Australia is imminent, or at least that part related to the LCR, the net stable funding ratio, has got a little bit further to run, not a lot. So from the beginning of next year, and I mean very much the beginning of next year, banks in Australia will be fully subject to the LCR. It's already had an impact on the pricing and nature of a number of financial products, as well as the structure of bank liabilities. And as I've said, we've also seen an impact in the bank bill market. So while the bulk of the impact may be behind us, there are still a number of changes in the pipeline. I think not so much around the terms of in terms of pricing, but still some around the redesign of a number of products. So let me finish there, and I'm happy to take some questions for a little bit.
Thanks very much, Guy. So can I ask for questions? We've got about 10 minutes. Please stick to liquidity.
Broadly speaking.
Does anyone want to kick off? No? Look, maybe Guy, can I start? You spoke a lot about changes on the in the deposit market as regards retail consumers. How about things on the commercial side? Any things you want to call out about that?
I highlighted that. I mean, it's right across the board on the deposit side. So one, and coming again back to something Professor Diamond said, so institutional investors aren't regarded as particularly sticky depositors. And so if you have a deposit from another financial institution, that's regarded as particularly unsticky. And so you've seen, again, banks being not paying as high a rate of return on those as they are on. So retail is really good. Corporate is pretty good. Financial institutions, not so good in terms of a deposit base. So obviously financial institutions still need to put their money somewhere, but just they're not getting as good a rate of return as retail. So you've seen both a desire to shift the maturity spectrum out wherever possible, but at the same time you've seen banks rejigging the composition, or at least the amount of interest they're willing to pay different parts of their depositor base. So in the end, you're still going to end up with roughly the same deposit base, but those depositors are going to get slightly differentiated rates of return depending on how good a deposit they are to the bank.
How about questions? Come on, I can't believe we've
Furry.
I mean, given your international role...
There's the mic.
Given also your international role where you are sitting on a number of committees and boards, I wonder whether you wish to compare how Australian banks are doing when it comes to liquidity compared to some comparable countries, if you like, around the world.
Well, I mean, the LCR kicks in fully for Australia this beginning of next year. Doug Diamond already mentioned about the US regime, which is not dissimilar to ours. I mean, the European regime is a more phased-in approach to liquidity regulation as it is to most of Basel III. One thing which is interesting, though, is if you think about liquidity in the context of the US at the moment, on one sense, there is no shortage of liquidity. given the size of the Fed's balance sheet. And so some of the more binding aspects of the LCR and the net stable funding ratio, for that matter, won't become apparent until we enter a more normal liquidity regime. We are in a normal state of affairs here, so the direct effect is very evident. In other regimes where there's sort of an excess of liquidity, the constraints that this new regime imposes is not quite so evident. As I said, there are some jurisdictions which are only phasing this regime in, I'm not going to get this exactly right, but over the next 2 or 3 years. And so, again, some of the effects are not binding. One of the things which we noticed here, particularly around the deposit repricing, is we were sitting there waiting for this to happen for quite some time, and it's only really happened in the last few months in terms of particularly around the adjustment of the conditions. So, for instance, an at-call savings account is not a particularly attractive beast from the bank's point of view, because the investor can just withdraw that whenever they want. But we've seen the competition in that space have been pretty hot up until probably only 3 or 4 months ago. It's only just started to back off now. So, a lot of these repricing and rebranding occurs fairly late in the piece, and in some jurisdictions I suspect they haven't got there yet.
And I think if I'm right, you said last year, Guy, that you were expecting the changes to go pretty well down to the wire, and that's what's happened.
Yeah, that's
happened.
Pretty much what's happened.
Exactly. Did I see some hands up at the back? Yes, please.
Lennon from the PM program on ABC Radio. So, Mr. DeBell, you said there's not enough high-quality liquid assets in Australia held by Australian banks, so would there be a systemic risk in the case of another financial crisis?
So the reason why there aren't enough is, as I said, for a good reason, which is there hasn't been so most jurisdictions, it's government debt is the bulk of the... makes up the bulk of the stock of high-quality liquid assets. We don't have a large stock of government debt, which is generally regarded as a good thing, not a bad thing. Consequently, that's why we've designed the regime we've designed, which hasn't been tested, obviously, and hopefully won't be, but we presume that it will work, to deliver the same sort of incentives, and very much the incentives along the lines of that Doug Diamond was talking about, to deliver the sort of... The desirable liquidity outcomes. So, one of the potential solutions to this problem was for the government to issue a very large amount of debt. That seemed like a fairly perverse way to address this solution, so we didn't go down that route. So, we've come up with a regime which is consistent with the Basel standard, is actually mentioned in the Basel standard, which we think will deliver the same sort of outcomes and to very much address the sort of issues you're talking about.
Can I just ask one quick follow-up? Do you think the banks are still too reliant on wholesale funding? Of course, since the GFC, they've increased the deposits they hold on their books.
I don't think so. I think wholesale funding is a part of the funding mix. One thing which I've mentioned in previous occasions, and it reflected in some of that there, so... A 90-day bank bill and a 90-day deposit are not that fundamentally different from a liquidity point of view. One is wholesale funding, or one is deemed to be wholesale funding, and the other one is deemed to be deposit funding. If you take the example of Northern Rock, for instance, yes, they had a funding mix which proved to be unstable, but they also had a deposit run too. So depositors proved quite adept on running on them just as much as the wholesale side of things. So... I don't think there's a clear delineation which says wholesale funding bad, deposit funding good. They're all part of the funding mix, and it's really the behavioural characteristics and the term to maturity which matters. And the liquidity regime, both the LCR and the NSFR, are very much around making sure that banks do the right, from a social point of view, amount of liquidity transformation, not too much, not too little. And to achieve that outcome, that will require a mix of funding. Not, as Doug Diamond said, one solution to this problem is that the banks hold 100% liquid assets and are completely depositor funded, sort of a narrow banking model. That's one extreme. Probably doesn't deliver society its best form of financial intermediation. So there's always going to be some mix of funding across the spectrum. There are clearly been some funding models which have demonstrably not good, and there are some which are probably too good. And so the challenges are finding the appropriate mix in between.
Could I see one last question? Perhaps there, if we can get us a mic down the front. Or was it, sorry.
A short question,
I can see. Sure.
I just want to ask, how did you come up with 15 basis point figure for the CLF?
So that you can look at that, we put up...
you might repeat the question.
Yeah, so the question is how... So I mentioned that we charge 15 basis points fee, which is for the access to the CLF. How do we come up with that? So the answer to that is on our website, but I can try and summarise it quickly here now, which is... I mean, basically, we sought to replicate, and coming to the question just asked before, to the same incentives that you would have if there was enough government debt on issue. So if you try and extract the liquidity premium from government debt, try and put some value on that, not a particularly easy thing to do, then that was our best estimate of that. So that the incentive for the bank is the same either way, if they were holding enough government debt, if there was enough for them to hold, or by accessing this facility. So it's designed to replicate the same sort of incentives that you would have in other jurisdictions where there is enough government debt to be able to use.